This episode of Heal Your Natural Wellness Podcast is brought to you by my ebook, Top 10 Foods for a Super Healthy Lymphatic System. Just go to healyounaturally.com/ebook to order it now. That is healyounaturally.com/ebook. Welcome to the Heal Your Naturally Wellness Podcast, a podcast about preventing, reversing, and treating health conditions by addressing the root cause. I am your host, Astrid. Join me here every 2 weeks when I interview interesting people such as coaches, holistic or functional medicine doctors, and educators from all different backgrounds about their own journeys while helping their clients achieve optimal health. In today's episode number 29, we will be discussing why women are more prone to SIBO, the symptoms to look out for, plus the latest science on how to reverse it. All links are in the show notes. Now let's get into the show. Hey everyone, today my guest is Phoebe Lapine, and she's a best-selling and award-winning food and health writer, gluten-free chef, wellness expert, culinary instructor, and Hashimoto's advocate and speaker. Through her own journey with Hashimoto's thyroiditis, she was able to find the middle ground between health and hedonism by making one lifestyle change 1 month at a time. She's also the host of the SIBO Made Simple podcast, where she equips people with information and how they can overcome their own underlying gut issues. Phoebe, welcome to the Heal Your Natural Wellness podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And I am so glad that we're going to be discussing SIBO. It's actually the first time that I have someone on my show talking about a very important topic. And so I'm very excited.
Awesome. Yes. I'm happy to be the first to tell people about SIBO.
Yes. Yes. And I think you are the right person. Obviously you are very knowledgeable about it, so I cannot wait. And as usual, we're just going to go right in. So why don't you briefly tell us about your journey into healing Hashimoto's thyroiditis? For starters.
Sure. Yeah. So I was diagnosed when I was 22 and just by my regular childhood doctor, which I know is very lucky since so many people, you know, have thyroid issues that go on for many years undiagnosed, because most doctors really only take TSH, which is, you know, kind of the barometer for how your thyroid is doing, but doesn't give you a clear picture on what level hormones are in circulation, and then no picture at all in terms of the antibodies, which is what's really needed to diagnose the autoimmune form of hypothyroidism. So I was diagnosed, I was told it was totally normal. I just need to be on medication for the rest of my life. And, you know, since I was 22 and super mature at the time, I was just like, yeah, I don't know, that doesn't really sound so great. So I just walked out of the office and pretended like the conversation never happened and went on living my life.
Good girl.
Yeah, I know. But in the years that followed, I was working myself to the bone, kind of catering and private chefing and doing any odd food job I could get. And it was very physical. And I really slowly kind of wore myself down to some sort of rock bottom. I had horrible perioral dermatitis, just like a rash around your nose and mouth. I lost all this weight and was really like struggling with horrible digestive issues, of course, not sleeping well, waking up in like a pool of sweat. Yeah. And, you know, eventually, obviously the eating issues was an occupational hazard. So I eventually found myself in the office of someone who was a little bit more holistic and put me on an elimination diet for the first time, and kind of did a ton of blood work, of course. And that was kind of my first foray into using food as medicine. Even though I had the skill set to do so, I just wasn't using it. And kind of exploring the other side of the coin. But I really felt like very overwhelmed by that trajectory as well. It kind of felt like there was a long laundry list of everything I needed to do to detox my life. And I was, you know, in my mid-20s and, you know, didn't have a ton of space or money to spend or time, and, you know, still wanted to have a social life. So that kind of is what brought me to write my last book, which was called The Wellness Project. I basically took a recommendation from Gretchen Rubin's book, The Happiness Project, and kind of took a step back and really decided to create a year long project to tackle each one of my wellness problem areas 1 month at a time. And, you know, of course the goal was to get my thyroid numbers under control, get my antibodies under control. But it had such a huge halo effect besides that. I mean, there was like such essential habits in terms of like sleep hygiene and hydration and learning to eat right without, you know, completely depriving myself of the foods that I love and without ruining my career. So that's kind of what I wrote about in that book. And kind of off the back of that, unfortunately, it was when I developed SIBO like 8 months after the book came out. And that was kind of my unexpected wellness project 2.0.
Oh, wow. That's incredible. So let me just back up a little bit. So when you discovered because you were pretty good. You actually, I didn't have to ask you. You talked about the symptoms of when you discovered you had. As far as I understand, hypothyroidism turns into Hashimoto's, or it develops, right?
So hypothyroidism, Hashimoto's is a type of hypothyroidism, but not every hypothyroidism case is necessarily the autoimmune Hashimoto's.
That's good to know.
So yeah, hypo just means that your thyroid has slowed down, is not doing what it needs to do to produce hormones or to convert hormones or to just keep your energy reserves intact. So if you have Hashimoto's, which is your body kind of attacking the thyroid, that could be one reason why it slows down. It's just because of all the scar tissue and abuse.
Oh, I know. And so I have someone in my family, who has Hashimoto's, and we managed to lower, I actually did it, you know, so with the information that I have to lower either THC from 8.0 to like 2.0, and with diet, lifestyle changes and stuff like
that's
that.
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was a good thing, but then their antibodies are constantly super high but they don't want to give up gluten. And I always say it's like all the bagels, all the bread and they're pretty active. They walk every day. You know, their job is active. And I'm like, you need to give up gluten. So how important, what is one of the best ways to lower your antibodies? I know that there is, you know, infrared light or like photobiomodulation, things like that. But what are, based on your experience, what are one of the best ways to lower antibodies?
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like just an anti-inflammatory lifestyle to some extent and just learning your triggers. I mean, so much of autoimmune disease can probably be attributed to just having a toxic burden that's overflowed. So I think as much as you can, like detoxing your life of, you know, certain chemicals. So switching personal care products to natural like items, I think that's huge. And it's not something that you really feel, you know, you wake up the next day and you're like, oh my God, like I'm healed.
Right, but it does
add up over time for sure.
You know what? And I apologize for cutting you off. And I think this is important for my audience because I know a lot of times they have questions after the fact. I'm just going to say this. I believe that one of the reasons why they're able to get away with so much gluten is because the rest of the lifestyle, mostly organic food, free of, you know, our cleaning products are, everything is like green, no dyes, no, none of that. The same thing with, the environment and EMF and all the stuff. Do you think that has an impact on why they're still able to get away with the gluten?
Yeah. I mean, it can be. I think all of it kind of adds together. I think it really depends on the person for the antibodies. I mean, some people, myself included, I think it's like more of a nervous system issue and like the way you metabolize stress and anxiety. That's a huge trigger for me is stress and anxiety. But then also, you know, I can do everything right on the lifestyle front, but then if, you know, something sets my body off, it's really hard to say. You know, I unfortunately let it get out of control for too many years. So I think my body kind of lost the ability to manage that switch. I don't know that I'm ever going to be someone who quote unquote reverses Hashimoto's and like gets the antibodies down to like zero permanently. you know, I would have to live a very small life in order to do that. And,
it's,
you know,
very restrictive.
Yeah.
Correct.
And it's fine. You know, I think there, the more that I read about it, like people get a little bit overly obsessed with the antibody piece. And while it does absolutely contribute to, you know, some feelings of overall health, depending on who you are, I know there are certain doctors who are like, you know what, like 500 is fine for that, for you, like for someone, that's a clinical win. But obviously, if you're in like the thousands, you may want to work
you
on
might
it.
Just
but...
wanna like, so is this the 500, are these functional medicine numbers? Or because we, you know that, right? Like in orthodox medicine, usually their numbers are not optimal. They are, they say a normal range, but as we know, in functional medicine, usually the ranges are much tighter and lower because we know that when you get to like conventional medicine numbers, you're pretty much in trouble.
Right. Well, for the antibodies, I mean, ideally you want them to be as close to zero as possible. So I think functional and conventional alike kind of see it that way. Although I will say, you know, conventional doctors who I've talked to don't really worry about the antibodies at all. Like, you know, I don't know. They don't really kind of understand the holistic component of having an inflammatory condition. So it doesn't really concern them. But I'd say for, these are functional doctors who I'm talking about, or we'll say that 500 is a clinical win. But yeah, it depends on your doctor. I just personally, from personal experience, think that it's not necessarily helpful to have a practitioner who's like so rigid about, you know, those numbers coming all the way down, because I think you can live a perfectly happy life. And, you know, so long as other things are working, then, you know, let's not stress overly on the numbers.
Awesome. I'm so glad you're mentioning that, because I know that someone out there is listening right now. And as myself, I'm on a healing journey. My issue has always been with glycemic and insulin resistance. Actually, as of recently, it became insulin resistance, even though I've always trained and I always battled with the weight, the hormones, still trying to get my hormones under control. And as you said, it feels so good to know that, you know, we try so hard and there are other people out there who are in the same boat, and we know that you're trying, and it's so restrictive sometimes, and it actually stresses you. It stresses your system more. And when your cortisol levels go up, you know, all the numbers go up. So thank you for answering that. It's good to know that we guys are all in this together, and you're doing your best, and that's what matters. Let's move on to the next question. Thank you so much for answering that. So can you explain what SIBO is, what it stands for? So in case our listeners don't know, and what are the possible symptoms they should be looking out for?
Sure. So SIBO stands for small intestine bacterial overgrowth, and it's really an issue of location, not type. So I think kind of one of the issues with, you know, the way that the wellness space talks about quote unquote gut health and good gut bacteria, is that we don't really realize that they're mostly just talking about the large intestine. That's where the majority of our good gut bacteria reside. And the small intestine really doesn't have much of a role for bacteria at all. It's where we absorb our own nutrients. And so when there are critters competing for our resources, it can cause a whole host of uncomfortable symptoms. The main one being bloating, because as bacteria eat your food, they release gas. And when they're so far away from an exit ramp, too far up, it gets trapped there. And so it can be really uncomfortable, like distension and just like kind of palpating it, like kind of hard, bloated, like third trimester level bloating. Yeah. And then, you know, it's something that occurs pretty much when you eat. So very much a correlation to food. But there's really like kind of the hallmark IBS symptoms, constipation, diarrhea, or a mixture of the two. The gas and the bloating would be the biggest ones. But then, you know, you can have leaky gut be a downwind symptom of SIBO, because again, the bacteria being like hungry little critters can damage the actual lining of your intestines, and the gas can also be very damaging. So then you get into the whole territory of kind of these autoimmune type symptoms that are a little bit harder to pinpoint. So, you know, skin issues, fatigue, brain fog, food sensitivities. And then I will say, for me, one of the strange symptoms was burping, because it makes sense. You know, the gas is trying to get out any way possible. So that for me was probably, because I've had a lot of, you know, IBS gut symptoms my whole life, but the burping was definitely different for this.
Really? Like how different is for our listeners who don't know the difference? Like,
well, I mean, it was just like constantly burping during meals. I don't remember, you know, it's not like just like a burp here and there. Like
it was, when it was during me, I'm sorry to cut you off. It was during meals particularly. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Gotcha. Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So those are kind of the main ones, but the list goes on. And, you know, of course, mood disorders, and so much of your gut is, you know, very much related to your mood. So depression, anxiety, weight loss, weight gain, depending on what kind of bugs you have overgrowing. It's really an interesting condition that's like the nexus of a lot of different risk factors. So actually a lot of autoimmune diseases are risk factors for SIBO. And then because of the leaky gut issue, SIBO can then be a risk factor for autoimmune disease. And Hashimoto's in particular, I didn't even realize is a big risk factor for SIBO for several reasons. Goes to show that, you know, when one thing in our body breaks down, it's so easy for other things to go off the rails.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That's actually pretty accurate. You know, we've talked about actually my previous podcast with Dr. Donnie Wilson. She was saying, you know, how we're talking about burnout, and how when you're stressed out, all the other systems get affected. So, you know, you're right on point. Excellent. Thank you for answering that. Now, why don't you tell us why are women more prone to IBS and GI, you know, gastrointestinal issues?
Yeah. So, I mean, it really does come down to the relationship between hormones and your gut and the way that we rely on our gut to process certain hormones. So I'll give you the Hashimoto's example first, but I'll just take a step back for a second and explain kind of the main reasons why SIBO can occur. Because when our digestive system is working properly, you know, we have bacteria coming in through the nose and mouth all the time, but we have all these systems designed to make sure that they do not take up residence in the small intestine, and they're either killed or they end up where they're supposed to be going in the large intestine. So one line of defense are all of the antimicrobial substances that we produce. So stomach acid, our bile acids, our pancreatic enzymes, there's kind of a whole, and our own immune system would be one of them. So there's kind of a whole bucket of root causes that fall under the category of the bacteria don't get killed. But then even if they were to end up in your small intestine, we rely on this mechanism called the migrating motor complex, which is essentially kind of a street sweeper wave that clears the deck after a meal and makes sure that there's no lingering food debris in our intestines. And it's super important because our small intestine is super large. It's like the surface area of a football field. It's really long and windy. Yeah, it's crazy. So it can very easily have a few bacteria pull off the highway and stay for a while in one of the nooks and crannies. So the street sweeper wave, the migrating motor complex, prevents that from happening. So kind of the biggest category of root causes would fall under the bucket of something goes wrong with that migrating motor complex. But then there's, you know, a third bucket that's just simply structural. You know, if you have something that's bearing down on your organs and causing them to not be able to move as efficiently or function as efficiently, you know, you think about it, it's like you have a 4-lane highway, something's pressing down, it becomes a 1-lane highway. And of course you're going to get some sort of buildup or traffic jam. So structural issues like that, Endometriosis, speaking of women, one that falls into that category and a few of the others. Because if you have a mass growing outside of your uterus, it's going to affect the digestive system and, you know, certainly bear down on the intestines to a certain extent. And then you have the laparoscopic surgeries for endometriosis to remove some of those masses. And any sort of abdominal surgery, unfortunately, there, even if there's very little evidence on the outside, we form internal scar tissue that can bind to certain organs and just heal differently. So anything like a C-section, hysterectomy, C-section. I'm mentioning... Mentioning the women-centric ones. But any sort of bariatric surgery can contribute to that, removing your gallbladder. So that's something to keep in mind. And it isn't something that is necessarily, you know, permanent and that can't be fixed. It's just a certain type of body work that's really targeted that you would want to do for that. But certainly, again, a lot women fall into those buckets, you know, disproportionately because of those surgeries. So back to the Hashimoto's connection and some of the other hormone-related connections having to do with the migrating motor complex. So for Hashimoto's and, you know, thyroid health in general, you have your active T3 hormone and your inactive T4 hormone. Those, again, if for a doctor that's doing a full thyroid panel, they'll be checking how many of both of those are in circulation. What happens is most people take, you know, a synthetic thyroid hormone medication for Hashimoto's or hypothyroidism. And usually that's just T4. So in your body, in your gut in particular, you have to convert that T4 into T3. So already, if you don't have a healthy gut, you're going to really struggle to convert your thyroid hormones and to have enough of them to function. And then ironically, the T3 thyroid hormone is also responsible for a lot of the functions of the gut. So if you don't have enough T3, you're not going to make enough stomach acid. You're also not going to be able to absorb your B12, and your B12 is what fuels the migrating motor complex. So that's why Hashimoto's kind of fits under several buckets: limited stomach acid, but then also limited motility via the migrating motor complex. So that is why some things can back up, and constipation is another big symptom of Hashimoto's. Mm-hmm. And then if you're not pooping, you may get estrogen dominance because you're not getting rid of, you know, all the extra hormones in circulation. Then the estrogen dominance makes it even harder for you to convert your thyroid hormones. So it is just a vicious cycle. In the book, I have kind of some fun little flow charts to make it easy for people to wrap their heads around, because unfortunately everything is connected. And because women's hormones are so finely calibrated, there's just a lot that can go wrong.
Wow, that was phenomenal. We're obviously going to link your book, you know, for them to be able to purchase it and everything in your dedicated page on my website and the show notes. So look for that, you guys. You know, as you were saying that, you know, if you are, so T3, you cannot absorb B12. If you have estrogen dominance, is that what you said?
Well, you're going to have trouble converting T4 into T3 if you have estrogen dominance.
T4 into T3. There you go. So that. Thank you for correcting. So, you know, I kind of talked about this in another podcast where, you know, I'm not going to get into it, but basically, guys, it's so important to, you know, like podcasts like this and bring Phoebe, important to talk about these things, because most of the times your doctors don't have enough time to go through this and explain. And a lot of times, sadly, they don't even know these things, you know. Like I always talk about, like, I'm going to my doctors and I go with like a list and I roll it down and drops on the floor. And I'm like, these are the lab work, the tests that I would like you to run. And they're like, what is this? And a lot of them did, you know, sometimes they don't even know what they are, but that's because we're geeking out on, you know, on our own. We're self-healers. We're good like that. So guys, pay attention to this. If you have symptoms, if you were, for some lucky chance, you, your doctor said, you know, you have estrogen dominance, you have the symptoms and like that, pay attention to things like these. Look, I've talked about this in other podcasts, but look how important it is. Hashimoto's has also very similar symptoms or, you know, to other conditions. Very cool. Thank you so much for answering that. Did you want to add anything to it, or that was that, right?
No, I mean, there's so many different overlapping kind of women-centric conditions. In the book, there's a huge checklist that you can go through to see kind of what your root causes are. And if you're, you know, worried about having some of these IBS-like symptoms, I mean, I will say, I forgot to mention earlier, but it said that over 60% of all IBS diagnoses are actually being caused by SIBO. And when you see the list of overlapping conditions and kind of some of the lifestyle things that can intervene as well, you'll understand why. So if anyone's interested in exploring that further, I would recommend it, because of course our guts and our hormone health is going to go hand in hand.
Oh yeah. And for us women, the more I learn about the hormones and how it's all, you know, intertwined, it's so important to look into that. Excellent. So another question was, actually I was going to ask you something about SIBO. Is there a connection between parasites and SIBO diagnosis? If you want to touch that on that real quick.
I'm not a pure and simple expert on this, but there is just a lot of overlap between like co-infections and co-opportunists and SIBO. The more interesting thing is actually, so it's an issue of location, not type. It can be perfectly good gut bacteria that's overgrowing just too far up, but often it will be a case of bad bacteria that kind of catalyzes some of the machinery to break down in the digestive system. So one of the most prevalent ways that people will get SIBO is just through a simple case of food poisoning or a stomach bug, something like an opportunist. So, I mean, parasites may fall under this category, though those are more long-term, but some sort of pathogen coming into the system. And then when your immune system attacks it, there can be a case of mistaken identity. So one of the antibodies that we produce to fight that infection actually damages the nerve cells of the migrating motor complex. So you might feel better, you know, a few days later because you've gotten that bad critter through your system. But then once the migrating motor complex just stops working properly over the next days, weeks, months, you may notice, you know, some weird IBS symptoms coming up. And that's very much like a direct product of SIBO. But then, yeah, parasites in general, Lyme, like lots of different co-infections can also overlap with SIBO. Again, it's like things that are messing both with the integrity of the gut and the function of the gut, but then also the immune system. Lyme is very much, you know, and mold exposure toxicity and just toxic burden in general, those are kind of messing with your immune system. And I mean, the situation I just described is when your immune system kind of goes off the rails a little bit, but we still need it in order to prevent further infection.
Exactly. That's great. Thank you for answering that. Something that I was going to ask in terms of like the foods, like you were talking about some of the foods before we jump into that question, I kind of lost it, but now it came back. So I was going to ask, the next question is going to be how to make food you enjoy while recovering from SIBO. But before you answer that, I just want to ask you something real quick. And I know you're very knowledgeable about this. How do you feel about sushi?
Oh, that's
so
funny.
I've been meaning to ask this to some of my podcast guests, and I think you are the right perfect person for this. I want you to tell me.
You're talking to a sushi fanatic, but for the purposes of SIBO,
I don't touch it.
You don't. Well, so, okay. I think that's very smart. One of my tips in the book, actually in the chapter about women, and specifically Hashimoto's folks, is, you know, unfortunately those things I described with, you know, low stomach acid, migrating motor complex as pokey, that is going to make you at higher risk for food poisoning. And then we know, like I just described, that food poisoning can lead to SIBO. So kind of my recommendation is, if you know that you have some of these issues, well, first you can, there are supplements that you can take to help with you to help, and some medications, but, you know, kind of eat like a pregnant person. Just think about that kind of stuff that any pregnant person would be paying attention to, and maybe thinking like, oh no, like I'm not going to risk it. Sushi, I think, is one of the lower, I mean, if eating like a pregnant person, I know a lot of pregnant people who do eat sushi. So I think it's from a reputable place. I wouldn't worry as much about it on the bacteria front. I'm not going to be eating deli sushi anytime soon. I did at certain points of my life, but those are my thoughts. And then the mercury, of course, you know, is not great. So eat, you know, veggie sushi or certain types of fish that aren't as high mercury if possible.
Gotcha. It's interesting that you said bacteria, mercury, and like that. My main concern with the reason why I personally, and I respect all the sushi lovers, shout out, because a ton of my friends are, just like I have vegan friends, I don't touch sushi because I don't, to me, the risk of parasites is much too high. I was reading somewhere that when you if you're going to consume sushi, and these are the experts, some of the fishermen and stuff like that, you literally have to flash freeze it within three minutes. I don't think 3 seconds. It's probably 3 minutes of catching it or something along those lines. So that doesn't happen, I don't think, unless they're that's for their consumption, I'm assuming. So that's my main concern. So thank you for answering that, guys. You know, but you said something that you said something interesting, that sushi is not on the top of the list. So I'm interested to hear, to the question, what would be some of the foods later on, and in the question, and so how to make food you enjoy while recovering from SIBO.
Yeah. Well, in terms of top of the list, I don't know. It's like, it's definitely different for a pregnant person, but if you look at actual foods that have like a high risk of salmonella and, you know, various outbreaks, you know, like potato salad that's been sitting out all day at a like July 4th picnic is like the most notorious, but like, you know, you don't see that on the list of like foods that pregnant people aren't supposed to have, but right. You know, just thinking about things like that, trying to be a little bit cognizant about,
how long it's
been
stuff.
Sitting out.
Oh, yeah, no.
So yeah, in terms of the diet component for SIBO, a lot of people really whittle themselves down to very few foods because, again, it's like your symptoms are directly related to what you're eating. And it's funny because like kind of the list of foods that I had learned when I was researching my last book as like quote unquote good gut foods, the list is the exact opposite for SIBO. Cause again, you're trying to limit the symptoms. So, you know, you want to take away some of the fermented foods, the probiotic rich foods, and then the veggies that are kind of rich in inulin. So how this translates is something called the low FODMAP diet, which is a very confusing chopped mystery box of a diet, but it's the main approach for SIBO. And then there are people who think, oh, well, yeah, like if you're on one of these diets, you're starving the bacteria. But in reality, I think it's more useful in just taking the gas levels down a notch so you can actually manage your symptoms and therefore, you know, have your immune system relax a little bit and recede so that there's actually opportunity to heal. Most people who have SIBO actually have to take some sort of antimicrobial herb or antibiotic in order to get rid of it. But the diet is kind of like a second part of the healing process. And low FODMAP can feel super restrictive, but I think that as you can see with the book, because there's like 90 really flavorful, delicious recipes in there. So long as you're able to, you know, borrow from your spice rack and diversify your plate with, you know, maybe some vegetables that you're not used to eating, that you're not used to even seeing at the market. That's kind of the key. But I also will say, like a lot of people with digestive issues, it's not the specific ingredient that's the problem, but how it's prepared. So if you have a really weak gut, or if you're living in a cold place during winter, you know, think about the fact that maybe like a big raw salad is not on the menu for you right now. And you want to stick with soups and stews and warming things. And if your gut's really weak, maybe you want to take the seeds out of your vegetables. Maybe you want to peel them. There's kind of a whole spectrum for people depending on what the damage is like and what their sensitivities are.
Wow, that's great. You know, and as you're talking about that, you know, it just came to mind, guys, you know, we always talk about this, be a little adventurous when it comes to exploring food. Once you're on a restrictive diet, you know, just think of outside the box. And that's why it's really good to read these books and get the recipes, because it gives you an idea. So it gets boring when you're restrictive. Like yeah. I fall off the wagon all the time, I'm going to be honest, because especially if there are times that I'm super strict, but then other times it's like, okay, well, you go to a get together, you know, I am Colombian. So let's say we go to a Colombian get together and there's like all the foods and it's like, no. And eventually I'm like, you know what? I'm going to try this. I'm going to eat it again. And sometimes you feel the effects, you know, when for me is I gotta, you know, I've always tested, you know, my morning glucose, things like that for prevention. And eventually, you know, like I was saying, you know, insulin resistance, after 40s, whatever. So I gotta watch double, but just be creative. Get the books, get the recipes, follow, Phoebe, and you could get some more, you know, really good information if you have SIBO and you've been dealing with this. You know, there's a reason why I bring awesome people to the podcast is so you learn to self-heal, because that's very important. Awesome. Thank you for answering that. Let's just move on to the next one. Why don't you tell me about some of the myths about the microbiome?
Yeah. So I would kind of go back to what I was saying before, you know, the gut encompasses our whole digestive system from, you know, mouth to butt. Yeah. So a lot of people will just lump it all in as like one entity with one function, with one microbiome, when in fact, each one of those areas, each one of those organs kind of have their own ecosystem. And the majority of the quantity of those, you know, good critters are in the large intestine. So again, I think that's kind of a misconception for people. It definitely was for me when I was even just researching my last book, because of the way people kind of throw around the language of good gut bacteria. But in reality, yeah, the small intestine is a totally different environment, totally in different bag, and it needs to be supported. So I think kind of another misconception is just, again, like there are a lot of people who will follow this advice, you know, of like eating all these fermented foods and drinking kombucha and, you know, like taking all the probiotics on the probiotic aisle. And if you have an overgrowth, that's just going to make you miserable. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people out there where, I mean, they may have a depleted large intestine too, but like kind of the immediate acute concern is not too little, but too much in the wrong place.
Oh, wow. That is so interesting that you talk about that, because I've learned eventually that, you know, bacterial overgrowth, but then I didn't know that you could have an overgrowth of good bacteria. Did I misunderstand? Because
in the small intestine, yeah.
So it may not be beneficial to have too much good bacteria in the small intestine. Is that
you can't have any, like you're not supposed to have much bacteria at all in the small intestine, because then it competes for your food.
Oh, okay. Look,
it's all supposed to be in the large intestine. That's kind of the misconception right there.
Oh, I learned something new today. Thank you for correcting me. So that's great. I love that. So you are not supposed to have bacteria in the small intestine because...
because it's where you absorb your food. So they don't really have a role. In the large intestine, they're kind of helping to digest the indigestible fiber. So they're essentially eating the scraps of what you can't use and helping to break it down. And they regulate a whole lot of other things, including hormones. They kind of have messengers amongst them that regulate the immune system, that regulates so much. So they have a lot of roles there, but just the way our body is designed. So we have bacteria are not us. So as I described with the immune system, kind of getting up in arms in the small intestine to fight certain pathogens, that can happen. And in the large intestine, there is a pretty thick mucus layer that separates your immune system from the contents, which is important because, again, if there was too much interaction between the immune cells and the bacteria, there'd just be a war. But in the small intestine, you're not supposed to have bacteria there. So the mucus lining is very, very thin. And if there are bacteria there, they can eat through it. It's literally made of certain carbohydrates that are in the FODMAP acronym. So we know that they like them. And then your immune system is just in constant contact with, you know, these critters that are not you. And they're not, you know, inherently bad. They're just not supposed to be there.
Oh, wow. That's very, very interesting. So some of the foods, just so we don't, I was just going to say something real quick. You know, I actually used to drink a lot of kombucha. You know, I learned about it. I love it. And so since I had removed juices and things like that out of my diet, even, you know, when I juiced, it was, and people, they'll know it was mainly 80, 20, 90, 10, you know, not a lot of fruit. But I switched to kombucha and I learned that, so kombucha, if you have candida, you don't want to touch it, things like that, right? Because it'll just exacerbate the symptoms. So I'd learned, so with kombucha, I learned that when I was making it with green and black tea, or if you buy it from the store, I don't know what they make it, you know, the bottled ones, but I learned that when you make kombucha with black tea, it was it had too much not enzymes, what is it, the other ones, not enzymes, but the what is it that's in kombucha that gives you like a rash?
Yeast.
Thank you. Okay. So black tea contains a lot of yeast. And when I was fermenting, I don't know. So making kombucha with black tea, and I started developing this weird rash in my left arm. And like to a point that one time it was like so red and painful. I was like, what's going on? So it was the kombucha. I started making it with green tea and it went away. Because
interesting.
Yeah, green tea didn't have. So I don't know if that is also when it's not fermented, that black tea has more yeast than green. Maybe it was when I was fermenting it, but I learned that not everyone, you know, I used to promote kombucha, so good for you. And then I also learned that kombucha doesn't have as much probiotics as we thought. So kefir, which is what I drink more often and I make it myself, has more benefits than kombucha, and it doesn't have that yeast and all that stuff. Correct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I still think if you have a yeast or candida problems, you want to stay away from the fermented foods in general. But certainly if you're reincorporating certain things, it sounds like I didn't know that about the black tea versus green tea, that kefir is a better one to just, you know, start out with.
Absolutely. Awesome. All right, cool. So thank you for answering that. We're going to move to the next one. And we talked about the myths of the microbiome. Did we talk about your experience with Hashimoto's and healing your thyroid issues already? Or yeah, there was something else?
Yeah, at the wellness project.
Right. Cool. Okay. So why don't you tell us about your mantra of healthy hedonism, doing right by your body without giving up your life when you have chronic illness?
Yeah. So that definitely applies to SIBO as well. And I was really glad I kind of went through the process with the Wellness Project and kind of figuring out what was worth my time, money, and energy. But essentially my definition of healthy hedonism is kind of where the things that nourish your body overlap with the things that feed your spirit. And those things could be anything from like a French fry to, you know, walk outside to, I don't know, I feel like we're redefining it for ourselves right now in COVID and realizing kind of all these things that fed our spirit that we took for granted. For me is like, you know, time with friends, like a dinner party. So yeah, it's again, kind of making sure that, you know, we don't become too dogmatic or overly obsessive with the things that can purely fuel us on a biological level and forget about kind of the mindset things that fuel us on, you know, a higher frequency, I guess.
Yes, that makes total sense. You know, sometimes we are just so hard on ourselves. And also, like you said, you know, in these times of, COVID, everything has been so restricted. And so, you know, we've talked about with some of my recent guests as well, you know, the impact that it's going to have potentially on your health, on your mental health. And, you know, definitely get out there. It's so important to, let me go back. How do you feel about, since we're talking about SIBO and stuff like that, so we know that earthing is beneficial, but also when you're earthing, you can also, some of the critters, can you get some critters through your feet? Like, I'm talking about, you know, like,
back in the parasites. Old days. Yes. Back in the old days. I don't think we have enough worms, just like in circulation right now in our country, since like all the deworming programs, there's an episode of my podcast on this actually on, helminth therapy, which is about reinfecting ourselves on purpose with intestinal worms.
Are you talking about fecal transplant?
No, that's chance? Different. I also have an episode on that.
Oh, but, I gotta listen to your podcast.
Yeah.
Really? That's interesting.
We go into all the nerdy gut health topics, but the worms used to pass from person to person just by walking barefoot, like outside, but it's not really the case anymore. But there are still, you know, lots of beneficial microbes that you can just have on your skin. You know, you have a whole microbiome on your skin, and there are all these spore-based probiotics now, which, you know, are said to just be like less than a teaspoon, like a quarter teaspoon of dirt. So it's honestly one of the arguments that people make for not like power washing your vegetables and for making sure to buy local, you know, vegetables that actually come from good, healthy soil.
Organic.
Because that does trickle down into our system.
Yes. All those organic, you know, most importantly, because you don't want those pesticides and prebiotics in the vegetables, right? The prebiotics.
Soil is a natural probiotic.
That's interesting. I actually didn't know that. Look at that, guys. I'm learning so much. I love it. Awesome. So just to kind of close up, you know, close the podcast. Why don't you tell us how to be on a restrictive diet, like the low FODMAP diet, without becoming overly obsessive?
Yeah. Well, I think with SIBO in particular, it's kind of divorcing the idea that if you have a symptom flare, it's actually a SIBO flare. So there are plenty of people who, you know, successfully eradicate SIBO and still get, you know, some IBS symptoms. You know, some people just are going to have a certain degree of IBS symptoms their whole life. We're just gut people. But also, you know, our gut is just constantly changing. And once we're on a restrictive diet, it just takes time to recalibrate sometimes. So I think with SIBO, you know, people just get very, very nervous that like, if I eat a certain food, my SIBO will come back. And that's just not the case. Even if you do feel the symptoms, it's not necessarily a correlation with, you know, the bacteria starting to overgrow again. So that's just something to keep in mind in, you know, just freeing yourselves to experiment a little more, because ultimately the health of your large intestine really depends on diversity. That's why earthing is so important. The more diversity you can have in your outer world, the more you're going to have in your inner world. And the easiest way to influence that is through diet and having as many plants as possible on your plate.
Phenomenal. Always, you know, eat the rainbow. And I'm not talking about Skittles. I'm talking about the vegetables. And, you know, I actually never liked Skittles, but anyway. So, awesome. Thank you for answering that. Wanted to ask, what herbs do you, or some of the, yeah, herbs for SIBO, for example, in terms of like supplementation or, you know, teas. I love my teas. I'm constantly, you know, playing with tea seins and things like that, that I remember my grandmother or that I go find. So what are some of the things that you would recommend in terms of supplement, or I'm thinking, you know, herbs that are.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a whole treatment protocol that involves herbs. Usually practitioners will mix kind of some single herbs, including oil of oregano, berberine herbs, and neem. And for certain types of SIBO, allicin garlic, which is like a very specific kind of antimicrobial compound in the garlic. And then there are some companies that'll make kind of these like compound herbs that have a lot of different things in them that are specifically, you know, antibacterial, antifungal, antiparasitic herbs mixed together. And yeah, they're incredibly effective. They're just as data backed as the antibiotics. So it is something to explore. And then, yeah, there are other supplements that I think are great for healing and for limiting symptoms. So I have a whole list of those. There's like a medicine cabinet cheat sheet in my book. There's like literally too many to even mention. That.
Where can they find it on your book? Is there something also on your website where they could potentially find?
Yeah. Yeah. So if you go to my website, feedmephoebe.com. I have an area called resources right in the navigation. And if you click on the SIBO drop down, you'll get lots of my posts about SIBO. When I originally was dealing with it myself, I wrote a three-part series that has a lot of links to various supplements and just will give you kind of the overview of what it takes to get through it. And then if you, you know, want even more information and the recipes, definitely pick up my book, and you can find that at SIBOMadeSimple.com.
SIBO. Okay, let me write it down. I think I have it. SIBO Made Simple, because I want to make sure that I don't miss it. I didn't have this. I will add it. I think I have it in my email, but excellent. So guys, you know where to find all of this good information. This basically concludes our podcast, but you can connect with Phoebe on feedmephoebe.com. And like she said, go to resources and click on SIBO so you could get that list and get other resources where you could, which could help you with your condition. Also, you could find her on Instagram. Like always, everything's going to be on my show notes. But her, let's see. Your Instagram is not working for whatever reason. So what is your Instagram?
It's just my name. Just my name, Phoebe Lapine.
Phoebe Lapine. Okay, guys. So you know where to find her. Phoebe, it is an absolute pleasure to have you. I learned
so
much. And I am looking forward to having you again. Is there anything that you wanted to close the podcast with?
No, just, you know, I'm always around chatting about gut stuff. So come find me. It was great fun chatting with you.
Awesome. It was great learning and having you. And guys, you know exactly where to go. You also know that I'm going to have a dedicated page on my website with all this information. And thank you so much for being here, for educating us. And I'm looking forward to having you again.